and I realize when I say spring break, that's not everybody's spring break. But next week, which is the 23rd, we will not be having Christian education. We will have church. And the team will be back the following two Sundays, the 30th and the 6th. So, this is an opening kind of meditation. This is Psalm, key verse from Psalm 31. And you, O Lord, have I made you ready. Let me never be put to shame. Deliver me in your righteousness. Find your ears in me. Make haste to deliver me. You're my strong rock, castle, to keep me safe. You are my crag and my stronghold. Say in your name, lead me and guide me. Take me out of the net that they have secretly set for me, for you are my power of strength. In your hand I commend my spirit.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I'm so glad to see you here. I'm really grateful for the response that we've had so far. Grateful and amazed. Because I'll tell you, I wasn't too sure. You know, when we first started talking about this thing, at the beginning I thought, well, no big deal. Yeah, we started saying, well, we're going to talk about this. I said, well, that's no big deal. It's something I know something about, and they're going to ask me to talk about it. Then everybody started talking about how brave it was. They said, you're really brave of the church to do this, really brave of you to do this. And the more they said it was brave, the scarier I got. Because I thought, this must require some courage. There must be something to be afraid of. And so I was really pretty scared. And wondering how things were going to go. And I had a lot of really nice responses right at the beginning. You know, people came up and said nice things to me, you know, at the end and said it was a good thing. And then I had some emails that were forwarded to me also, and I thought I'd share just a little bit of that. You know, I said thanks to anyone who helped facilitate this. It was really nice. So many of us need what Steve has to say. That was nice, right? Kudos for scheduling it. Outstanding. Thanks to Steve for presenting difficult topics and leading us to an understanding and healing. Those were forwarded to me. This is from somebody, though, who I know. This was a fantastic job today. Wasn't that nice? Obviously a topic of interest. Also, I must say I was delighted to learn that I do not have an addiction problem, just an erection problem. And thanks for clearing that up for me. So you'll remember that we used that maybe silly example to lead us into the idea of shame and blame, and the idea that what we think makes a person be the way that they are determines how we treat them. That is, how I judge the problem. You know, how I say to myself, well, whatever's going wrong with a human being, what made them be that way, that's going to determine for me how I treat them. Now, that's as an individual, as a society, clinically, in our field, what we really think makes people be the way they are determines how we treat them. And that's the theme, the ongoing thing. And you'll remember that we talked about that blame and shame idea. We're really interested in whether or not what's wrong with you is your fault. Because somehow or another, if you deserve it, in our minds, that makes it easier for us to take somehow or another. And it protects us. Remember, I said it protects us with the idea that maybe it won't happen to us because we're hoping that we don't deserve it. And we also talked about the incidence bias, you know, whether or not we're expecting to see a thing. We talked about that. And we're going to look at that a little further today because we're going to talk about childhood issues. And specifically, we're going to talk about childhood in terms of trauma and the things that happen, how we become the way that we do. And in order to do that, we've got to look at just a little bit about how anybody becomes the way that they are. And then we're going to look at it in terms of what this means about things going wrong with us and problems that we have as adults. So let me first introduce just the idea of personal space in terms of physical boundaries. You know what I mean when I'm talking about personal space? Everybody's kind of got it, right? You know how you know you've got personal space is when somebody gets in it, right? So when somebody gets in your space, you're suddenly very aware of it, right? I used to have a guy that I worked with, and I called him the space invader because whenever he talked to me, that's the way he wanted to talk to me. You know, he wanted to get very, very close to me. And I have a different sort of a space thing going on. You know, my space thing's a little more arm's length. And as a matter of fact, if you watch me when you're talking to me, you'll see that I'm a little better sideways. And if you're coming to get right in front of me, you can start making me dance. He's trying to get in your comfort zone, right? You're trying to get where your space feels okay. Well, how does that come to be? Well, it seems like probably part of it is a thing that we call trait. That is probably a sense of space is something that we're born with, right? Natural. There seems to be sort of a sense of space that all human beings have. It's sort of the shape of an egg. That is, right directly in front of you is sort of the point of the egg, because in my face or coming directly at me is the place that I'm most sensitive, right? That's even why we use that language. Something, boy, it's coming right at you, right? And that's the place that my space is probably the most sensitive. And then at the sides, we seem to be the least sensitive for some reason. And then there's sort of the round part of the egg here behind us, right? And so everybody sort of has an egg-shaped space thing that they seem to be born with. Does that make sense to you? And you're not really aware of it all the time, but you really kind of know that you can feel somebody behind you if they get close enough behind you, and you can tell when somebody's next to you. And it's the reason that we're sideways with our enemies, where I got sideways with him, right? Does all that make sense to you? Well, then, if we're born with that, why do some people sort of have more and less? Well, part of that is trait too. Probably some families you just have a little bit more sensitivity, and then some a little bit less. But then there's how our physical space is handled as we grow up, right? It's how much you're touched and how much you're held and how huggy your family is and stuff like that. You know how huggy your family is, affects how huggy you are, right? I'll tell you how I discovered this. My family, not so much. Not so much. We're kind of packed. Little lean out, little pat on the back sort of a thing, right? And we're real good side huggers with a pat. We got a side hug with a pat thing going on. And the first time I ever went to a girlfriend's house, I think it was sort of an Italian family, and I thought that I was being molested. I mean, I wasn't really sure what was happening. Because, they're coming up and hugging. The dad came and hugged me. Like cheek to cheek hug, I don't really know what was going on. Because it's just a different sort of a thing, right? And so you get some of your sense of space and some of your sense of physical boundaries from the way that you are handled as a child and the way that it's taught to you. Now, all of that makes sense, doesn't it, in terms of physical space? And right now, if we wanted to, we could find out what yours is. We could find out. You could stand up and you could figure it out with somebody, and you'd find out that it's different for different people. The better I know you, the more likely it is that you can get close to me and I'm comfortable. And we'd find out all kinds of interesting things about it. And we could figure out that you had learned, that is the state, the things that you had learned over time about your physical space and your boundaries in terms of physicality. Now, the same thing, as it turns out, is true about emotional stuff too. Now, doesn't that make sense? It would make sense that some emotional stuff we're probably just born with. We're going to go back to this trait idea. Don't you figure that some things we're probably just born with? As a matter of fact, many of us think that there's an idea that there's a me that exists before any layers of learning come along. Like some of us who are more spiritually minded will say things like, I'm a spiritual being having a physical experience. Right? There was a me that existed before this physical experience, and there's a me that will exist after this physical experience. Might use the word soul, we might use some other language, but some of us will think that. We'll think that there is a me, and I'm having a physical experience, but the me existed prior to that, right? And then some of us will say that there's a pre-nurture natural man. This is sort of a more scientific approach to it. Is we'll say, there's a me that comes born into this world before there's any learning at all. We're going to call this the natural man or the natural human state of being. And then I got to tell you, in Western society, most of us kind of mush those two things together. And we kind of will say that there's some of both of that, right? And we won't be able to tell you exactly how much is what either. But we end up just sort of thinking both of those things are sort of true. And if I said, how much of you today is made up of any of that, we'd have a hard time telling, wouldn't we? We'd have a hard time saying, well, I'm not sure how much I was born with and how much I was taught. I'm not sure how much I came into this life with. So we need to simplify it a little bit in order to understand what happens to us as children. Let's go with an idea that as I come into this life, I come in primarily a feelings being and not so much a thinking being. When I'm a baby and I'm born, I'm more of an experiential kind of a being, right? And we come in with the ability to feel, we call this the big five: happy, sad, angry, afraid, and sexual. That babies pretty much can do that without being taught. You know, sort of the idea is that really nobody has to teach a baby how to be mad. It's like nobody says, okay, screw up your little face, cry till a little vein pops out on your forehead, you know, and that's how we'll know you're mad. You know, it's like actually babies seem to be able to do that, right? And babies are sad, right? Babies that know how to cry when they experience loss or don't get what they want. And actually, happy baby, I mean, grown people just go nuts trying to get the happy baby thing, right, out of them. And babies have a known and measurable startle response. It's one of the things that we measure in children. So babies seem to be able to feel all of this, including sexual feelings. Babies are known to have sexual feelings because they'll touch themselves if left to their own devices because it feels good, right? And then we immediately strap it in plastic and say, no more of that for the first year. And I'm not really sure exactly what that does, but so happy, sad, angry, afraid, sexual, right? So we come into the life with the ability to feel those things and to experience those things. And that's probably trait, natural. Does that make sense? All right, then what happens is we start teaching about that right away, don't we? The very first thing that we start teaching is what we want and what we don't want. That's called preference. We would prefer to have a happy baby, right? So that's the very first thing. Now we introduce a bias immediately that the baby did not have. Because see, when we come into this world, babies just like happy, sad, angry, fat. That's all good. You know, everything about that is good. Everything that they're feeling, everything that they're experiencing, as far as the baby knows, it's what's supposed to be happening, right? That's until we start going, no, no, no. Rather be happy, trying to get the baby to be happy, right? So we introduce the very first bias through training, which is that we would prefer happy. And we have all kinds of biases about that. It's because we definitely don't want a sad baby, we don't want an angry baby, we don't want a sexual baby, we do not want any of those things, we just want to have a happy baby. Isn't that true? Then we introduce a male and female bias into it too. Because actually, we really don't want little girls, little girl babies, to be angry, do we? Little boy babies can be angry, little girl babies, not so much. And little boy babies, we don't want them to be afraid either. We don't want little boys to be afraid, and we don't want little boys to be sad. You know what we do? We call them names when little boys are afraid and sad, don't we? Call them sissies. Call them weak. And we got a name for women, too. If you're angry, especially if you're angry sexual, you know, we got a name for you, too. We call you Bossy. Right? You know, we got names that we call people because we immediately introduce a preference based on sex about which feelings we think are going to be good feelings and which feelings we think are going to be bad feelings based on sexuality. Right? And then beyond that, how about the feelings that maybe in our family weren't okay to have? In almost every family, there's the idea that maybe there's some feelings that are not particularly okay, right? Maybe it's not okay to be afraid ever. No fear is the plan. Maybe we just don't tolerate crybabies. Maybe we don't want to be angry at all. We definitely do not like for our children to be angry and try to talk them out of it, right? What about sexual feelings? As we're raising children, I mean, I know all of y'all are healthy, and so all of y'all were just able to talk about things openly, right? Happy, sad, angry, afraid, and sexual, we just talked about all those feelings. Can you imagine being raised in a completely healthy family when at puberty you walk into the family room and you go, hey, what's this? Something going on here. Wonder what's happening. And you just talk about it in the same way that you could talk about any feeling that comes up, right? But many of us didn't experience it that way, did we? And now we get into the area of things that become more problematic. Is that here we are, we're introducing all these biases that most of us kind of think are normal, but along the way, we start to make some pretty serious judgments about that. And we start to teach some really interesting things about feelings and the nature of feelings. But it's definitely not okay to happen. I mean, my mom would say, you know what? you can just get glad in those same britches you got mad in. You know, why don't you go to your room? And what I was taught was that if you're going to be angry, you're not going to be able to be with the family, right? If you're angry, you don't get to be with the family. So you better control your anger so that, you know. Now, I got to tell you, when you're little, all of this, when I'm saying it to you right now as an adult, it makes sense. When you're little, it doesn't make sense. You know, when you're little and you're crying in your room, your father comes into the room and says, son, there's nothing to be afraid of. You know, all he's really saying is, I want to comfort you so that you go back to sleep so I can go back to sleep because I've got to get up in the morning, right? That's what he's saying. But what he told me was there's nothing to be afraid of when clearly there was. There was something in that closet, right? I mean, I knew there was something in that closet and there was something to be afraid of. So what happens is the person who's the greatest power in your life comes in and denies your reality and tells you that what it is that you're feeling is wrong. How good for us do you imagine it is to be told that whatever it is that we are experiencing is wrong? You know, how many times do you think that happens as we grow up? That we get told that the experience that we're having is not the experience that we're supposed to be having. And as a result of that, we begin to doubt the things that we are experiencing and doubt whether or not it is what's supposed to be going on inside us. And a lot of us have that happen to us. Do you know what I believe is the most repressed feeling in childhood? Out of the five, happy, sad, angry, afraid, and sexual, do you know what I think the most repressed one is? I think it's happy. I think happy is the most repressed feeling in childhood. And everybody looks at me like, what? Well, see, we all say that we want our kids to be happy. Almost everybody who has kids will say, I just want them to be happy. That's what we say. But there we go. Not in here, not too much, not too loud. Over there. Right? Isn't that what we say? We want you to be happy. We just don't want it to be too loud and too annoying. Right? Kids are happy. Have you noticed it? They're exuberant. You know, they're loud, they're happy. We're the ones that spend all the time going, shh, 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 right? We're happiness repressors, right? And how did we get to be that way? Well, it was done to us, right? Isn't that true? Weren't you taught to calm down? Calm down, calm down. And so we all get taught these things. You know, we get taught these ideas about our feelings. You know, and I think it's a dangerous thing just in general. Because we have this bias in our society toward intellect versus feeling, toward our thoughts versus our experiences. It's a huge bias that we have in Western scientific thinking and in Western religious thought. You know, in religious thought, we have a tendency to believe that emotions, the feeling states that we're having, are somehow or another wrong, and that the top of our brain, the thinking part of us, is a better thing, and that our spirituality somehow lies there. It allows in our thoughts, and somehow this part of me is closer to animal, right? That its base, somehow or another, is supposed to be controlled by my thoughts. And in Western scientific thinking, in my field, in psychology, the thinking is that you've got this nice, neat hierarchy. That is, I have perception, I perceive things coming in, like through my five senses, I perceive things. Then I have thoughts. I think thoughts about the things that I perceive. And then I have feelings. So as I perceive things, I think about them. As I think about things, I feel. That's the hierarchy, right? And so in that scenario, which most people love and most of our thinking really love, our thoughts are in control of our feelings. Now let me ask you this. How many times has anything that you've thought been wrong? I mean, a little bit? A lot? How often were you absolutely sure about something that later turned out not to be true? Little? A lot? Right? It turns out we're wrong all the dadgum time. You know, we're wrong much more often than we're right. In fact, we are wrong so much of the time that we're protected from knowing how much we're wrong. Most of the things that we think turn out not to be true, we just forget that we thought. It's true. It's true. Your brain can't stop making decisions. And so as you walk into a room at any given moment in time, it's constantly making decisions. it comes in and says, oh, there's not too many people here this time. Maybe they're not going to show back up again. Oh, whoa, there's some more. They're starting to come in and go, oh, I think, you know, and it just starts. And as it makes decisions, it throws away the old decision. And all of those were wrong, and you just forget. You forget that 7 things that you thought, or 10 things that you thought, or 14 things that you thought were wrong. In fact, I am absolutely burdened by the reality that almost always I am wrong. The thoughts that I happen to think and the decisions that I make. There's a famous experiment, a psychology experiment in our field, where they show that you can bring in a group of people who have an idea about something that can be easily disproven. That is, I have this concept, but it can be shown to be false. And you can change their mind about it. With facts, it's pretty easy to change your mind about a relatively small fact. So we bring these people in who believe a certain thing, and then we show them the fact, and they change their mind. Here's the interesting part. Not that they changed their mind, but within 7 days, they have forgotten that they changed their mind and think the original idea was their idea. That's the way we all are. That's the way we all are. So let me ask you this. Your thinking is often wrong, and I just told you it's wrong more than you thought. And if my thoughts are in control of my feelings, isn't my emotional life in the hands of a known liar? Tell me why that's a good idea. So we also have a bias toward thinking, right? We decide which emotions are right and which emotions are wrong, and we have this bias toward thought as if we're going to think our way out of it. Maybe we should pay more attention to this thing that's called emotional intelligence. I don't really love that. It shouldn't, those two words really shouldn't go together. But it's probably a better predictor of whether or not I'm going to be happy and healthy in life. The truth is, intelligence as measured by IQ, that is pure brain power, not a very good predictor of happiness in life. Not a very good predictor. Instead, or success. Instead, the ability to be in relationship with other human beings happily and successful, that's a good predictor of whether or not I'm going to have happiness in later life. And the thing that most is affected by that is not the thinking part of my brain, but the way my emotional boundaries were handled as a child, right? What I was taught. Was I taught that it's okay to have feelings? Or was I taught maybe not so much? Was I taught that it was okay to only have some feelings? Maybe not so much. Do you know that we think that about a third of people at any given time in this room laugh without making a sound? Almost always gets you. Because we're taught that, right? And we're taught that it's not okay to be angry. And gosh, how many men are taught that it's not okay to cry? Where did we get that? I mean, taught that it's not okay to cry. Now, on the other hand, we're definitely taught that anger is a good thing. It stuns me in our society where we have so much violence going on and so many problems with violence, how that is exactly what every young boy grows up believing is heroic. Think of any movie, any hero movie that exists at any time, and here's the theme and what happens in the movie. Is our hero, who is innocent, suffers all kinds of indignities, and it's really important that somebody innocent that he loves suffers as well, right? So he suffers indignities, the puppy suffers indignities, everything is going wrong, right? At some moment in time, what's he allowed to do? Rise up in righteous indignation, right? And then what can he do? Well, he can wreck the whole city. He can kill everybody. He can chop off your head. And you know, he's still the hero, isn't he? Still the hero. Doesn't make any difference what all he did to the bad guy, because the bad guy deserved it, right? And that's what we're all taught. Women, not so much, right? Not so much. Now, what I'm going to argue to you is that all of this teaching and training, as innocuous as it sounds, leads us to all kinds of problems that we call trauma. Now, it leads us into some really difficult areas of trauma in childhood, as if this part is not difficult enough for us to overcome. I don't know where that train us up in the ways of the Lord, and when he is old, he will not depart from it, comes from, but I want you to know that's a curse, not a promise. You know, because that training up, that's hard. You know, it's hard to get away from. It really is hard to depart from the things that you were taught, even if you decide not so much later in life. But what about especially if there was a ton of anger in your household? What about if there was a lot? Or violence? What do you grow up thinking about, you know? What if there was none, no anger or violence in your house? Which would you think is better? You'd think none, right? As it turns out, both of those things create an interesting kind of trauma, which is you don't think anger should happen, right? If I had too much anger in my house, I'm afraid of it and I don't want it to be there because it's dangerous. If I grew up with no anger in my house, I'm afraid of it because I think it shouldn't be there and it seems dangerous, right? What we really need is the ability, of course, to talk about and handle our anger appropriately, don't we? But many of us didn't get that. Especially in the areas of anger and sex are the places where we have the most trauma in childhood and the most trauma in families. I'm not going to ask you to do this in here. I am not asking you to do this. But I want you to know that if in a room this size, that if I were to say, you know, women, prior to the time you were 18 years old, how many of you experienced some sort of unwanted sexual approach from an older man? How many of you? You would be stunned at the number of hands that go up in this room. Then if I said, how many of you had happened before you were 12? You'd be stunned at the number of hands that go up in a room. Then, after that, while all the men are feeling sad about that, I go, okay, men, how many of it happened to you? Some sort of unwanted sexual advance in your childhood before you were 18, then before you were 12. In men, the number is lower. They have a more difficult time because of their upbringing understanding what unwanted is. But it's a lower number, but it's still, you would have a lot of them raising their hand, right? And so then we come into our adult life, and what we want to be able to do is have happy and healthy relationships that are based on being able to be in a feelings type of relationship with other human beings. How in the world was I supposed to do that? Yeah? How was I supposed to do that? How many of you got some pretty good training in how to feel your feelings and how important that was to be in a relationship? How many of you got any training at all in how to be in a happy, healthy relationship? I didn't get any. I knew that I wanted it. I wanted it bad, but I didn't have any training in how to do it or how to go about it. I didn't know what this stuff meant. I use my wife as an example when I talk to you about this thing we call post-traumatic stress disorder. A lot of this stuff just causes us problems. But there comes a point in time where it actually causes us dysfunction in our lives. If I have enough bad teaching about this in my life, I'll start to have some disordered things that happen. And what that is it causes me enough problems that it causes dysfunction in my life and makes things difficult for me. The story that she told that I can tell, and I found this out not long after we were together, is that it turns out that a leather belt makes a very distinctive sound if you take it off quickly. Never occurred to me. A leather belt wasn't part of my childhood. For her, it's a little bit like a grenade going off, right? Because she had a childhood experience where the sound of a leather belt coming off pretty quickly, man, that brings up all kinds of danger. And I didn't understand. I didn't understand how that worked. But it works a little bit like the thing that we call post-traumatic stress disorder. Maybe even exactly like the thing that we call. You guys know what that is in terms of war, right? We used to call this sort of shell shock, combat fatigue, other things like that. The idea that a really horrible thing can cause enough of a problem inside of you that you still have a strongly abnormal response to it later on, or a strong and powerful, you can't really say that's an abnormal response, so it makes sense that you would have that response, but a very powerful response to it later. You know, so the thing that they show on television, doesn't really work this way, but the thing that they show on television about a veteran in a helicopter or something like that, and it causes them to duck, you know, and we all have that. We all have that. You wouldn't believe the people who are coming to my office right now still talking about the snow day 4 weeks ago. You know? You know, where were you? I couldn't get to my child. It was terrible. No. talking about things. So we experience this sort of institutional, like a post-traumatic stress disorder. But the things that happen to us in childhood are usually the hardest. Yeah? They have the biggest and most profound effect on us. That they have a big and profound effect on us in terms of the things that we think are okay for us to say, okay for us to do, and okay for us to feel. It especially happens to us in the areas of the things that, between male and female, that we think that we're allowed to experience. I gotta tell you, that happy thing is a big deal, but in particularly in women, that it's okay for you to be sad or afraid, but it's not okay for you to be angry or sexual. And in men, it's okay for you to be angry or sexual, but it's not okay for you to be sad and afraid. That causes us all kinds of huge problems. And it's very difficult for us to overcome those things. And then, together, we experience these other problems where there's too much anger and violence or too much sexuality in childhood that causes all kinds of serious problems later in life. And I want you to know the problem that I have with it is we don't talk about it. You know, we don't talk about it. I don't see why it should be brave for us to talk about this in church. It makes me sad that we say that. You know, it makes me sad that we say that this is a place. Do we think that this doesn't happen to us because we're people in church? No. Everybody had a perfect childhood because we're in church. Some of my trauma occurred in church. What was the one? PTCD, post-traumatic church disorder? I can't remember what percentage of Episcopalians are here because of post-traumatic church disorder. I mean, that's why we're here. You know, because of that, that's how I got to be Episcopalian. I mean, you know how many stories start that way, right? And so we know that it exists and happens. What I want to do is I want to convince us all that because of the belief system that we have, that we're ashamed. And that we shouldn't talk about these things, it keeps us from coming in and being out loud with each other about the stuff that hurts. It keeps us from coming and saying the things to each other that are going to allow us to heal and make us better. So my argument to you is that as we stand here today, we just all admit that this is true. That there's a large percentage of things like this that have happened to us, and we could start right there. One of the nicest things that happened to me at the end of last week, it took me by surprise, a fellow that I knew, I'd seen in church, but I didn't even know him, walked up to me and says, "Hey, I'm glad you were talking about that. I'm an alcoholic." And I laughed. And he said, no, really. And it was just a really pleasant experience that we could connect on that level, right? We wouldn't have talked to each other like that before. And I probably will talk to him some more. What a nice thing, right? What a nice thing. One of the things that they told me was brave about me doing this when I started asking questions, said a lot of people in the church are going to know you a lot better after this. And I said, is that bad? And I'm reasonably sure that it's not at this point. So let me tell you what we're going to do going forward. We're going to take this 1 week off because we're thinking that most people won't be around. And then we're going to move into some stuff about anxiety and depression, big things, anxiety, depression, and suicidality. That's the things that we're going to talk about in the third week. In the fourth week, on April the 6th, we're going to talk a lot about solution. Okay? So sort of in keeping with Lent, we're going to stick with problem, 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 and then solution is at the end. Right? So we're going to talk about it in terms of, I'm trying to give you lots of good description of how things happen. Arguing all the time that the way that we speak about it is important, and then in the fourth week we're going to be much more into this is what we can do. In addition to talking about it out loud, these are the things that are healing and these are the things that will work. So thanks for listening to me. So I have 5 minutes. Go ahead. Yes. Yeah. So Martha Jo, what she said was, it's amazing to her how some people are able to rise up and overcome and seem to be, you know, that they are able to do well. And then other people, here's what she said, seem to wallow in it and use it as their excuse for not doing well. And so I'm prepared to quibble with the second part of it. It's true that there are gigantic differences between the way people that respond to it. I just have a lot of grace for the reality that some people are more resilient than others. You know, I just have a lot of room for the fact that people, not all babies are the same. You know, not everybody responds the same way. Not every child responds the same way. There are things that were traumatic to me that might not be traumatic to you. And the effect that it has on me might be much more profound and much more disordered than it would have on you. And I think we're on pretty dangerous ground when we begin to judge people and say that because some can pull themselves up by the bootstraps, everybody can. I would not argue with the grace of God in church. So his question was, and he's hoping I will get into it, that is it easy to tell the difference between the things that are sort of in your head and the things that might be physically wrong with you? Is this thoughts and feelings, is it psychology or is it physiology and those sorts of things? And the answer is no, it's not easy. Most of us who think about these kinds of things a lot have a tendency not to make as big a distinction, to not say is it either or. And to instead think more holistically with the idea that that one thing always interacts with the other thing. And so I'm less comfortable with the idea that you can tell that. That doesn't mean that I'm not going to speak to the reality that there is biology and physiology involved. You can tell that by the sort of genetic thing that I'm doing. So it's going to be there. But I don't think there's ever a time when I'm going to say, oh, well, it's definitely all in your head or definitely all in your body. And we can know that. Does that answer that? I'm sure I have time for one more. What he said is that some years ago there was a book that came out called Emotional Intelligence, and it went around the business circuit trying to get people to learn more about this relationship and intuitiveness, more gut, but because we realized that it's not all just head. And he said, is that the same thing? And that's exactly what I'm talking about. The way that, if it's Daniel Goldman's book, the way that he talks about it's not precisely the way I talk about it, but conceptually it's the same. This is really a lot of fun for me. I hope y'all are having fun. I'm going to see you in 2 weeks. 2 weeks.